I'm Dr. Brian Goldman, host of the CBC podcast, The Dose. Each week, we answer vital health questions that will help you thrive, like, what does my mental health have to do with my gut? How can I prevent melanoma? How much sleep do I really need? And how can I manage my health without a family doctor? I chat with the top experts to bring you the latest evidence in plain language, all in about 20 minutes. Find The Dose on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Nora Young. This is Spark and our special series, The Butterfly Effect. A central idea of chaos theory is that changes to initial conditions of a system will affect its outcomes. There's a classic metaphor for illustrating this. Something as small as a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the ocean can lead to a tornado on the other side. In other words, a seemingly minor action can set a system on a massively different course of events. And that's what we're focusing on in this series. Over the course of 10 episodes, we'll look at small inventions that have gone on to change the world. So much so that it's hard to imagine what life would be like without them. Welcome to The Butterfly Effect. It's safe to assume that when someone talks about the pill, we know exactly what they're referring to. And that's a testament to the impact the birth control pill has had since it was first developed. First approved over 60 years ago, today millions of people take it daily as a form of contraception and as a tool to manage menstruation. It remains the only prescription drug that's taken every day by healthy people.
They come in big bottles for a year's supply, smaller bottles for a month's supply, and handy calendar packs that fit in a woman's purse.
Often credited for launching a sexual revolution, the birth control pill was considered groundbreaking when it first hit the market. But what many didn't expect was the far-reaching reverberations it would have beyond preventing pregnancies. This week on The Butterfly Effect, we're looking at the many consequences of the pill on our culture around sex, contraceptive technology, politics, and human rights.
The common man is such that he can't afford to have too many children.
It's not natural for a woman not to ovulate.
I think people should be able to make up their own minds.
I think it's marvelous.
That ability to plan one's family allows women to make other plans, education and career path and so forth. It just opens up the world of possibility to women.
People felt like they needed a method that was much more effective than anything that they had available before that. There's no question that it's been tremendously important for reproductive freedom.
Well, I think you can argue that it was one of the most important inventions of the last century, that it not only gave women power and control, it changed the dynamics of marriage, it changed the dynamics of sex, and it's hard to think of too many other inventions that rank as powerful as this one.
Our three guides for this episode each bring different expertise and perspectives from the field of reproductive technologies.
I am Diana Blythe. I'm chief of the Contraceptive Development Program at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development at the National Institutes of Health.
My name is Crystal Littlejohn. I'm an associate professor of sociology at the University of Oregon, and I study race, gender, and reproduction, particularly among young women.
I'm Jonathan Eig, and I am the author of The Birth of the Pill, among other books. As long as people were having sex, people were trying to avoid having babies. And there were many, many techniques, most of them fairly inefficient, and most of them in the control of men. So the big thing that Margaret Sanger envisioned and that others envisioned early on in the 20th century, even as far back as, 1914, 1915, was a form of birth control that women could control.
It was only available to married women, and that later changed through the courts, where it then became available to non-married women as well. But because of social norms and thinking about sex and sexual behavior, it was seen as something that was appropriate for married women, but not for anybody else.
Are you on the pill yourself?
Yes.
Are you married?
No.
When you're married, do you expect to be on the pill?
Yes.
How large a family would you like to have?
Two children.
Are you married?
No, I'm not.
When you are married, how many children would you like to have?
Two or three, possibly.
And therefore you would want your wife to be on the pill?
Definitely, at least for a couple of years, till I get started.
In your book, Birth of the Pill, you shed light on four figures who played a pivotal role in the creation of the pill. Can you tell us who they were and a little bit about them?
Sure. I mentioned Margaret Sanger, and she was a very early advocate of birth control in America in the early 20th century. In fact, invented the term birth control. She had the vision that women needed to protect themselves. Women needed to control their own fertility, and went around preaching. And she really identified it as early as 1915 or so, that what we needed was a miracle tablet, as she called it, something that women could take every day, not just in the heat of the moment when they were preparing to have intercourse. And you could use it to prevent pregnancy, but when you wanted to get pregnant again, you could stop taking it, and your body would return to at least the potential of reproducing. But for decades, she talked about it almost as if it were a fantasy, as if it were science fiction. And then by the 1950s, the science began to catch up with her. We began to understand hormones and the way they worked. And that's when the other players entered the picture, because she met a scientist, a biologist named Gregory Pincus, around 1956, and said to him that she had this vision for a miracle tablet. And Pincus just said, oh, I can do that. Sure. No problem. Because I understand how progesterone works. And if you give women progesterone, it's conceivable, no pun intended, that their bodies might be tricked into thinking they're pregnant and they wouldn't be able to have more children. So that's where I would start.
Progesterone is the hormone that controls a lot of the reproductive cycle. So the birth control pill contains a progestin that mimics progesterone and convinces the ovary that pregnancy has occurred. Therefore, a new egg is not made each month. And at the end of the cycle, the uterine wall sheds and starts another cycle.
And once Sanger heard that, she found a funder who was willing to back the whole thing, because this was all illegal. Even spreading information about birth control was illegal in much of the country. So she found a woman named Catherine Dexter McCormick, one of the richest women in America, who agreed to fund the entire project. And then Pincus added on a guy named Dr. John Rock.
If taken as it should be, one pill every day for 3 weeks, it will stop ovulation.
Dr. John Rock would run the clinical trials, who understood how to work with patients, because Pincus was more of a lab guy. And then along with another biologist in Pincus's lab, M.C. Chang, they went to work. So it was really just four or five people at the core of this thing, with no government funding, no corporate funding, really on their own.
Yeah, this was one thing that surprised me, was the extent of this one woman bankrolling so much of the research that went into this.
It's really extraordinary, and it just goes to show you, the power that a few people can have when they set their minds to do something, but also goes to show you how unlikely that it would ever happen again. This was really like an opening, a moment in time when this was possible, and how they slipped it past the Catholic Church and past the FDA and past politicians is just remarkable.
As impressive as these origins sound, there's a complicated history with unethical clinical trials and figures in the eugenics movement among the drivers in the development of the technology.
They were not terribly concerned, these scientists, with how women were treated, with who was treated. They began by working in insane asylums and giving it to women and men, actually, without any consent. They began also by giving it to women who were seeking help with fertility problems. Women who were desperately trying to get pregnant were among the first people to receive the progesterone treatments that prevented pregnancy. And then from there, they moved to Puerto Rico, the slums of Puerto Rico. And again, without consent, without knowledge of what they were really doing, without even really understanding that this was an experimental drug, women in Puerto Rico were among the early trial participants.
That's a key part of the story of how birth control came to be. It was very difficult to do clinical trials in the United States at that time. And Puerto Rico was chosen in part because they could do the research there, right? But it also gets us to think about, just like today, right? There are particular populations of people who are understood as being open for researchers to access. And that is explicitly tied to power dynamics and to racial and class dynamics that are steeped in inequality. And so in this case, there were many poorer women. There were women who couldn't read or write that were in the study. And that was framed as a positive thing because the idea was that if women in these places who had trouble with reading and writing could consistently take the pill, then it would show that in a broader population of people who could read and write, then it would also be possible. But that's problematic, right? It's problematic to target a group of people and a population of people that you are targeting particularly because of their status. And so when you think about the fact that our pills were tested on women who met the description of folks that whose fertility we think should be limited, I don't think there's a way around the coercive and oppressive nature of that particular study.
During discussions about finding test subjects, Catherine Dexter McCormick is documented saying, this is a quote, "How can we get a cage of ovulating females to experiment with?" Which maybe tells us something about how things were seen at the time. What about the birth control movement's efforts to appeal to eugenics, which was a prominent idea in science when the pill was in development? What do you make of that?
I think it was a marriage of practicality that Margaret Sanger and others saw that the eugenics movement was already doing some of what they said were setting out to do. The eugenicists had already funded birth control clinics and were sterilizing women, in fact, in Puerto Rico. So the fact that there were already doctors and nurses set up to reach out to these poor women in Puerto Rico helped the people doing the research on the pill get started. It gave them a place to find patients. So in some ways, there are signs that Sanger may have had some agreement with some of the causes, some of the philosophy of eugenics movement, but not all of them. And that's still a part of her legacy that we're debating today.
You're listening to Spark from CBC Radio.
We often think of groundbreaking innovation as pure science, separate from society. But the very origins of the pill's development are nested in the politics of inequity. As the pill moved closer to becoming a reality, it had to be marketed in a way that made it palatable to the evolving sexual mores of the day.
They knew they couldn't get this thing approved as birth control right off the bat, so they described it to the FDA in the simplest possible terms, that this is a medicine that helps women control their ovulation. And for women who have irregular ovulation, irregular cycles, this pill will help them regulate it. And of course, they knew what that meant. But and women knew what it meant too, because as soon as they heard about this, they realized the potential, not just to control when they menstruated, but also to control their fertility. So as soon as it was approved in 1956, the women began demanding it from their doctors, knowing exactly what it would really do for them. And in fact, the pills, the bottles at that time came with a warning, may prevent pregnancy. So it right. really wasn't much of a subterfuge.
Yeah. From what I understand, the pill wasn't initially available to single women at all. Could you tell me a bit more about the stigma that existed at the time around non-married women and sex?
Well, right. This was we were still a much more conservative society. And one of the choices that the creators of the pill made was to make sure that it was available only by prescription. They wanted doctors to prescribe it. And that was really also part of their strategy. They wanted the doctors to give it legitimacy. But it also had the effect of making it off limits to women who might need it most, women who weren't married, who were concerned about becoming pregnant. But society at the time was really there wasn't much of a constituency for single women who wanted to have sex. It was considered such an unmentionable act that something people didn't talk about openly, that there was really not much chance of getting the pill into the hands of people who were not married.
Do you feel that the pill is immoral?
It's immoral. I feel it's medically unsound. I don't think it's right for healthy women to take pills when there's something wrong with them.
Are you Catholic?
Yeah. That doesn't really make too much difference, I don't think, if it was really necessary. The only reliable form of contraception is abstention, which isn't really very good either, is it?
So how exactly did the pill alter the conversation around sex kind of in those early years?
I think a really important change was thinking about sex as something that could be decoupled from fertility and from having children. And so before the pill came to market, it was really difficult for women and people who can get pregnant and their partners to be able to manage their fertility as they would hope. So people ended up having more children than they might have wanted. They might have ended up having more pregnancies than they would have wanted, in large part because they couldn't be sure that their birth control method was going to work. And when the pill came to market, you had this first time where you had a very effective method that could offer a promise of being reversible, of being something that the person could take themselves to make sure that they had full control over their fertility. And so it dramatically changed the landscape, and it made it where sex could be something that could be enjoyed and didn't necessarily have to be accompanied by this deep fear that a pregnancy was going to result and that a person's life could dramatically change just because they wanted to enjoy a sexual experience with their partners, whether married or not.
So there were other contraceptives already out there before the development of the birth control pill. So what was the motivation behind developing the pill?
Well, many of the other products, such as condoms or the diaphragm, which were, I think, the most common ones that were out there prior to the pill, require using during or just before intercourse. And that connection to coital activity is oftentimes a deterrent to using it at the moment and spontaneity and so forth. So there is a high failure rate with condoms and diaphragm in typical use compared to the typical use failure rate for birth control pills. And even in perfect use, the birth control pill is highly effective with a failure rate of less than 1%, whereas perfect use of condoms or the diaphragm is significantly higher than that.
And so how effective was the pill in its early years?
Well, in its early years, it was extremely effective because the amounts of hormone they started with were extraordinarily high, higher than they needed to be, but people didn't know that. So they started with very high levels. And over the years, as side effects or adverse events began to mount, and they realized that in particular, blood clots and those kinds of events, which are rare but not that rare, were triggered by very high concentrations of estrogen in the pills. So they began to lower those estrogen levels over the next decades. And now all pills, all combination pills, have fairly low estrogen levels so that the risk of blood clots is extremely low. And it still occurs. Generally, it occurs in individuals who have a high risk factor that they may not know about, such as a family history or some sort of Leiden factor, things that have been identified as more higher risk for blood clots. Those individuals also have a much higher risk from pregnancy of blood clots as well. And so, again, that factors into the protection that the birth control pill offers to women who are trying not to get pregnant, in particular, might have a health risk of a blood clot.
Right. So what were the main concerns about the pill that were kind of voiced by the public in the early days of its use?
Well, I think in the early days when the what we call venous thromboembolism or blood clots began to emerge, that was unexpected and frightening. And initially, it wasn't known what the factor was. So as it became clear that it was the synthetic estrogen that they were using at the time in concentrations that were maybe 10 times what they're used now, wow, they realized that they needed to cut back. So I think perhaps that may have contributed to some of the negativity in those days. Nowadays, it feels as if people complain more about mood or some other, you know, side effects they may be experiencing. And, you know, people are very variable. And, you know, many, many, many people have little or no side effects. Some people have benefits. And we've experienced this in another trial where it's the male who's taking the method, that some of the women wanted to go back on their birth control pills because they didn't like being off them.
One of the things that I think is really overlooked is the fact that using prescription birth control can be hard and it can be tedious. And so we're talking about people trying to prevent pregnancy for decades of their lives. And so one of the reasons that women provided for why they didn't want to use prescription birth control was just that it was tiring. And related to that was a central concern with side effects, which we have ample research on. Side effects are a key reason why women express dissatisfaction with their prescription birth control methods and a key reason why they stop their birth control methods. And so the tedium of having to manage a contraceptive regimen for years on end, coupled with the experience of side effects that people might experience during that time, really created a perfect storm for some women that made them feel like they just didn't want to use their methods. And I do want to be clear that even though some women stopped using their methods, many women continue to use their methods, even as they experience frustration with side effects or frustration with just daily management of their routine.
So a lot of it is a little bit of trial and results to see what works. Trying to improve, trying to lessen side effects, trying to lessen mood effects and increased weight gain. And so, again, it's trying to figure out what's the best method. If somebody's experiencing bad effects from one, they really should try a different one because they're not all the same.
And so that's what lies between specifically the proliferation of forms of hormonal birth control, is that just trying to get that those different balances, right?
Yeah. And again, if someone has a predisposition to a mood change with, let's say, levonorgestrel, would they do better on drospirenone, which is a very different mechanism of action, but it's similar. They both have progestin-like activities, so they both effectively inhibit ovulation, but they have different properties. So one person's, you know, reaction to one formulation may not occur with a different formulation.
We'll have more with Diana Blythe later on in the show. She'll talk about future developments in prescription contraception and why there's still no pill for people who produce sperm.
Hi, I'm Asha Tomlinson.
And I'm David Common.
And we're hosts of CBC Marketplace. We're award-winning investigative journalists that want to help you avoid clever scams, unsafe products, and sketchy services.
Our TV show has been Canada's top investigative consumer watchdog for more than 50 years, but this is our first podcast.
CBC Marketplace podcast is available now on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
In this year of 1967, it is against the Criminal Code of Canada to disseminate any information on birth control. The University of Toronto Student Administration Council has decided to defy the law and openly distribute advice on where to get the pill and how to use it.
This really concerns us and nobody else.
If a student is going to use birth control pills and is going to have sexual intercourse and is going to have an affair with somebody, it's better they should, like, get the information than conceiving a child or something like that.
Perhaps having to leave university because of it.
That's right. I mean, if they feel this is right, they're going to do it regardless.
I'm Nora Young. Today, another in Spark's occasional series, The Butterfly Effect. This time, the long reach and surprising impacts of the birth control pill. Now more with Jonathan Eig, author of the book The Birth of the Pill, and Crystal Littlejohn, author of Just Get on the Pill. As we heard earlier, the history of the birth control pill is filled with stories of unethical clinical trials and ties to the eugenics movement. But problematic practices and rationales aren't only things of the past, in spite of the potential of the pill for reproductive freedom.
Ideally, methods like the pill could be a tool for liberation, where people who are trying to prevent pregnancy have access to the methods that they need to prevent pregnancy. They have free access to them. They have unbridled access to them. And they have access to those methods without the sense of pressure from their partners or anybody else. Right? And that would ideally be birth control use as a tool for liberation. Instead, what women in my study experienced and what someone in my study experienced and what women have experienced historically is kind of a coercive phase of birth control use where you have these methods being pushed on them as something that they must use to prevent pregnancy at the expense of shared responsibility in their relationships. And I think sometimes the kind of coercive face of birth control gets hidden because socially there tends to be a tendency to lead with this messaging around birth control being a tool for liberation, but also a lack of acknowledgement of the coercive politics that undergird that messaging. So there can be this emphasis on the importance of preventing undesired pregnancy as a costly social problem, for example. And so this message is people need to use birth control because it's expensive to have undesired pregnancies. And that kind of sidesteps the challenges that people have with using birth control, right? My study shows there were lots of women who wanted to prevent pregnancy, but they wanted to do it by having their partners wear condoms. And so when you have this messaging that just says we need to get women on highly effective prescription birth control methods because undesired pregnancies are costly, we lose sight of the fact that a part of the reason why some of these women aren't using birth control is because their partners refuse to wear condoms.
Over the course of its history, how else did we see the pill being used as a tool of oppression, particularly in context of race, class, and gender?
It gets so complicated, and it's different all over the world. You know, one of the reasons that they were able to get the pill approved is that they really promoted it more on a tool for population control, especially at a time in this country and in this world when we were concerned about overpopulation, that we were going to run out of resources. So it was much more politically acceptable at that time to talk about population control than it was to talk about liberating sex or providing equality for women. Those were more controversial at the time than the issues of population control. So a big part of why the pill is able to get off the ground is because they're talking about these things that at the time were politically expedient.
So one of the ways that we see the pill being used as a tool of oppression is most explicitly with race and class. And so when you look at race and class differences in undesired pregnancy, you see that people of color and lower income women are most likely to have undesired pregnancies. So even as we see this broader messaging that says, hey, we need to get people, just people generally, on birth control to prevent undesired pregnancy, there's actually a more subtle targeting of low income women and women of color because they are the most likely to have undesired pregnancies. And I think one of the things that's particularly challenging about that, even though on its face it'd be a good thing, I think what's hidden in that discourse is the idea that there are also differences in the ability to call a pregnancy desired. And those differences are not just related to people's feelings about having kids, right? Some of that is related to people's structural context. So some people would like to have children, but they can't. They don't feel like a child could be desired at that point in time because structurally, for example, they don't have enough money to be able to take care of children. And so on the one hand, you can say, okay, the solution is getting this person on a prescription birth control method so that they can stop a pregnancy from happening. But in reality, what that person needs is actually support with housing so that they could feel like their pregnancy could be desired. And so the solution isn't actually getting them on birth control. The solution is rethinking our social policy so that this person also has access to the ability to call a pregnancy desired and to want a pregnancy at that point in their lives. I mean, that's just one example of the ways that our discourse around preventing undesired pregnancy can target particular classes of women, even as it seems more neutral to the broader public, who have perhaps less knowledge about how this kind of stuff works. But then I think even beyond that, just more generally, the ways that contraceptive methods have been used against people of color and lower income women. In California, a few years ago, there was this report that found that prisoners were being sterilized without their knowledge and consent, right? And it was explicitly linked to class, right? So one of the people responsible or for overseeing the program explicitly mentioned that these babies that would be born would be born to, right, these poor women and would be more likely to become criminals in the future, right? So even today, where I think people think of kind of sterilization abuse and these challenges with reproductive oppression, some people think of it as being in the past as it relates to contraception, at least. You see contemporarily that there are a number of ways that birth control use can be put to coercive and oppressive ends. And I think the key for me is working to surface those experiences and those instances, especially when they are hidden from public view. And the only way to surface them, right, is by doing the research with people on the ground to understand what their experiences look like.
Could you tell me a bit about how the language around birth control options often excludes trans or intersex people's experiences or LGBTQ plus people's experiences?
This is something that I hope will change quickly as our language continues to shift. But it's so common that I think people completely take it for granted that we talk about male birth control and female birth control, or we talk about women's methods and men's methods. And this discourse obviously ignores the fact that this is part of a male-female binary, and this is part of a cisgender framework, and it completely renders invisible the needs of people who don't fit into those categories and who still need access to prescription birth control methods. And I think that it fits into this larger discourse of this gender division of labor that is based on the male-female binary and holds that cis women do X and cis men do Y. And we know from lots of research that there are a whole host of ways that our medical system ends up feminizing responsibility for contraception, and the ways that the broader development of contraceptive tools continues to place responsibility only on one partner for preventing pregnancy. But even within that context, it's focusing on female bodies and male bodies to the exclusion of trans and intersex people, particularly for trans people who are doing gender-affirming care, for example. They need information on how a birth control method that they might be interested in could affect their care, right? And we just don't even have a framework that acknowledges that that is a part of people's experience, because the framework is so heavily focused on cis men and cis women and the male and female gender binary. And so there's a complete lack of emphasis on the contraceptive needs of trans and intersex people. There's few knowledge campaigns, right, about what that could look like and what that should look like. And so I think that there are a whole host of harms that can seem like they're not occurring because our society tends to be so steeped in gendered ideas.
Today, reproductive control is a divisive political issue in the U.S. in particular. But interestingly, it wasn't always that way.
Well, the big issue was the Catholic Church. But at the time, at least politically, there really wasn't much of a divide. Republicans and Democrats were united in their belief at that time, for the most part, that this was a good thing for women, that women should have the ability to control their bodies, decide when they wanted to get pregnant, decide when they wanted to start families. And you see the impact almost overnight. It's really shocking. There's not too many moments in American, in world history, really, where you can see an invention trigger this dramatic a change in society. Almost instantly, you see the number of women enrolling in four-year college increasing, the number of women staying in four-year colleges all the way to their completion, the number of women enrolling in graduate programs, becoming doctors and lawyers, the age at which women marry, the age at which women have their first children, the size of the family. It all begins to change overnight when the pill is approved.
Yeah. I understand that some politicians would argue in favor of the pill and family planning by suggesting that it would be good for economic growth. Is that true? And what do you make of it?
Well, it was good for economic growth. In fact, you can look at the states that approved the pill earlier than others, and you can see the women entering and staying in the workforce longer. You can see the women, as I mentioned, getting more education sooner. And studies have been done that show that the states that first got the pill did show economic gains as a result of that, and health gains as well.
Over the years, we've seen how contraceptives are wielded to suit both sides of the political spectrum, to suit feminist and non-feminist reproductive politics. Where do you see that play out in the history of the birth control pill?
Well, the pill was different in that it was seized so dramatically by women. You know, they took this up on their own. And I think that they made it almost impossible for political rancor to surround its arrival. It would be foolish to try to take this back from women when it first appears on the scene. The demand for it is so great. So I think it's worth reminding our constituents today, our listeners and our readers, that birth control and even abortion was not a political issue until really the 1980s, I think, is when you can start to identify when certain politicians in the Republican Party in America began to recognize that this was an issue they could use to change the political dynamics, that they could try to divide voters in the South in particular and religious voters. And they made the birth control issue, they made abortion an issue that became partisan, but it wasn't. And it didn't have to be, and it doesn't really have to be now.
Right. Because at a certain point, part of the discussion from an anti-abortion perspective came, well, there's the pill, so you don't need things like abortion, right? It was sort of, it did come to play a somewhat of a role in that sense.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, people today still argue that if you are opposed to abortion, you should be in favor of all other birth control. Because if your ultimate goal is to avoid the termination of pregnancies, then let's just do everything we can to avoid pregnancies. And that would also include giving people the economic support they need to start families when they're ready to start families.
Mm-hmm. You've talked a bit about some of the social changes that followed the pill, especially for women. Did it also precipitate the development of other forms of contraception?
Yes, it did. Even when they were working on the pill, they began talking about whether it would be possible to create some kind of a hormonal male contraception. It also led to advances in IUDs and other long-term forms of birth control. I think it became clear that there was a huge demand and that there were profits to be made, and that helped the drug companies invest more. There's still not enough investment in birth control because it faces such a long and difficult climb to approval, and because the risks of lawsuits remains very high. Because these are healthy young people taking birth control pills or using other forms of contraception, if something goes wrong and if there is a side effect or if there is a long-term ill effect, the risk of litigation is super high. So that still prevents a lot of the research and development that we need to see around new forms of birth control.
How many women can remember to take a pill every morning? Do you automatically become pregnant if you forget to take a pill? I've heard that.
Well, it requires more than cessation of the pill to become pregnant.
The packaging of the pill has evolved, though. It didn't always come in, you know, we associate it with that sort of compact-like case. It didn't always come in that kind of packaging.
Right. That was a big problem. It came in bottles like most pills, like aspirin. And it was difficult for people to remember whether they had taken it or not. And women would lay them out on a table on a countertop and, you know, mark the days of the week on there. And the advent of the circular disc, the disc that contained the tablets, was a huge innovation, not just because it made the pill more effective, it made it easier to remember to take it every day, but also just because it became kind of a totem. It really became a symbol of power and pride.
Jonathan Eig is the author of The Birth of the Pill, How Four Crusaders Reinvented Sex and Launched a Revolution. It will soon be staged as a theatrical production.
The birth control drug known simply as the pill.
The pill is the most popular form of birth control.
Using the pill is something you do when you have your orange juice in the morning or a glass of water at night. You can take the pill without ever admitting that you're sexually active.
I think the pill has made sex much more fun, which it should be, much more enjoyable, which it should be, much more normal, which it should be, and much more healthy.
I'm Nora Young, and today on Spark, the seventh installment of our series, The Butterfly Effect. We've been talking about the pill, not just the profound impact on contraception, but how it, like most technologies, intersects with power and politics. Sociologist Crystal Littlejohn is the author of the book Just Get On the Pill. In it, she looks beyond the pill's origins to explore the social implications. We tend to think of prescription contraception as a tool of empowerment, but she writes about what she refers to as gendered compulsory birth control.
So gendered compulsory birth control is a term that I coined to reflect the idea that women and people who can get pregnant are really channeled into accepting primary responsibility for preventing pregnancy, specifically using methods that are designed for their bodies. And so my book is based on just over 100 interviews with young women. And over and over and over again, they talked about how their partners told them that they should just get on the pill, how their parents, when they learned that they were having sex, would try and take them to clinics, right, to encourage them to get on some kind of prescription birth control, how their friends talked about the pill being the next natural step for them to pursue once it was clear they were going to be having sex. And then also how medical providers could also channel them into assuming primary responsibility for preventing pregnancy using a form of prescription birth control. And so what oftentimes happened was that you'd have women who were interested in preventing pregnancy, but they weren't necessarily wed to the idea that it had to be a prescription form of birth control, but all of the various social messages that they encountered suggested that they should pursue prescription birth control use as the thing to do. And so gendered compulsory birth control refers to that, this idea that we expect women and people who get pregnant to do their part to make sure that a pregnancy doesn't happen, and it's their job to do so using prescription birth control.
Can you talk to me a little bit about what some of the consequences of this uneven division of labor and responsibility in birth control have been?
There are really dire consequences, right? My book uncovered the ways that women could feel pressured into using prescription birth control. So rather than having prescription birth control use be something that felt empowering to them or that felt liberating, it could feel like something that felt coercive. So women would say things like, I had to get on the pill, or they put me on the pill, right? There was definitely this undercurrent of discomfort, dissatisfaction, a sense of coercion, explicit coercion for some women. And so on the one hand, one of the consequences was this sense that birth control wasn't something that they had the liberty to do per se. It was something that they felt like they should be doing. A second consequence was that they tended to focus on preventing pregnancy, and there was much less emphasis on making sure that they were protected from disease.
So given what you've said before about the effectiveness of using the pill, though, what exactly is the nugget of your concern over this gendered responsibility for birth control?
The key is that because of this widespread emphasis on only placing responsibility on women and people who can get pregnant, we can decenter reproductive autonomy and reproductive freedom. And I think even if you don't care about reproductive autonomy and reproductive freedom, one of the challenges is that there's just this assumption that this is just what works, right? That channeling women into using prescription birth control is, even if it undermines their reproductive autonomy, even if it undermines their bodily autonomy, this is what works. But my research shows that women themselves had a hard time preventing pregnancy when they were channeled into only using prescription birth control, right? You had some women who had trouble refilling their prescriptions. You had some women who just preferred not to use a form of prescription birth control because of side effects, because of dissatisfaction, because they wanted their partners to help them. And instead of having support for that, they ended up encountering partners who would try and get out of using condoms.
What did the people that you talked to say about their feelings about this?
So women expressed a great deal of frustration. And obviously, right, I coined the term gender compulsory birth control. Women in the study didn't talk about it in those terms, but they talked about it in terms of over and over again, this sense of frustration that women themselves had to be the people that were largely responsible for preventing pregnancy. And that sense of frustration carried on for some women for many years as they face partner after partner who believe that they should be responsible for preventing pregnancy in their relationships. And some women even expressed surprise, right, when they had partners who were willing to use condoms without any pushback, right, and who were just willing to kind of do their part to prevent pregnancy because they were so used to having partners who would give them a hard time about having to wear condoms or trying to make excuses to get out of it.
What about the pill for men? Is that a practical possibility?
Unfortunately, most of the hormones or the chemicals that inhibit sperm production also have very toxic effects. And also, some of the researchers point out what woman would trust her husband to take the pill?
I mean, the pill's been around for over 60 years, so why is there still no male prescription birth control out there?
It was perceived as risky to try and start developing contraceptives that target sperm because you have a market of methods that are available that have been used by women and people who get pregnant for, as you mentioned, decades and decades and decades, and they have tolerated side effects, right? You know that they're going to use these methods for decades on end. And so when it comes to try and get funding for developing contraceptives that target sperm, that has been trickier because there have been all of these questions that are fundamentally gendered, right? These questions about whether or not men will tolerate side effects, whether or not it is a good bet to try and develop methods that target sperm when you're not sure if people actually use them. Whereas in the case of methods that were designed for women to use, there wasn't a question about really whether women would use it or not, right? The assumption was they need these methods, they're going to use these methods, we need to develop these methods. The notion that men won't use them has been a lot harder to dispel, even as you do have men who have expressed interest in having methods that are available to them. Thankfully, that's been changing in recent years, but for a long time, that has been a key issue in developing new methods.
Crystal Littlejohn is an associate professor of sociology at the University of Oregon. She studies race, gender, and reproduction, particularly among young women.
And why do you feel that it's not immoral?
Because I feel that people should have the opportunity to judge for themselves as to how they're going to conduct and rule their lives.
You are listening to Spark with Nora Young.
From CBC Radio.
We just heard about some of the social factors that influence why there is still no pill for people who produce sperm, but there's also active and promising research in this area. For more on the current state of the science and why it's taken this long, here's Diana Blythe.
So for male contraception, using those same principles I talked about at the beginning, a progestin that inhibits the pituitary hormones that control testosterone in the testes. And testosterone in the testes has to be at a very high level to support sperm production. So if we use that same feedback pathway of in giving them a progestin, it makes the pituitary think that they don't need to make LH, the hormone that is going to make testosterone in the testes. So we shut down that loop, and as a result, the testosterone drops in the body and sperm production stops. However, if we didn't then give them back testosterone in the blood, which again is at lower levels than what's in the testes, they would begin to experience side effects such as not having the ability to have an ejaculation and libido and maintenance of muscle mass and things that would not be good. So we use testosterone, and that keeps the body functioning as if, you know, it was being made naturally, but it doesn't reaccumulate in the testes at a level that can start sperm production again. So we're in a large contraceptive effectiveness trial right now where couples agree to use this as their method, and the couples are at risk of pregnancy. So we can do earlier studies, which we did, to find out what's the best concentration to use and whether or not it inhibits sperm production and whether all the men recover without the women being at risk of pregnancy. The real test is couples who are willing to use it to prevent pregnancy. And it takes a certain amount of faith on the part of the female partner to stop using her method and rely now on her partner who's sperm count has reached a threshold that we believe to be contraceptive, but the informed consent can't promise that there will not be any pregnancies. So it takes a certain amount of courage, I think, and we're very grateful to the couples who've enrolled in this study. And it takes about 2 years for them to participate in this study. And they get to the end of it, all the men, when they stop using the product, they recover their normal sperm counts. Many of them have asked if they could re-enroll. And that's really quite a testament to how much they liked it. And they can't, but it's nice to know they'd like to.
Hmm. When did scientists start researching male contraception?
They were researching it back in the 60s. There are some very interesting studies that were done with a different drug using a different pathway, but one that inhibited sperm production in humans. So there have been animal studies that preceded that. So I would say probably 80 years, a long time.
So why do you think it's taken so long for this form of birth control to progress to the point that it's at now?
Well, there have been some trial and errors, if you will, along the way, things that worked, things that didn't work. The hardest thing has been similar to the problem with estrogen in women, that the natural estradiol can't be delivered by a pill. Natural testosterone can't be delivered by a pill. It's cleared so rapidly that it requires multiple doses per day, which wouldn't be practical. Mm. And synthetic testosterones have been associated with liver problems. So those sort of fell by the wayside. What we're doing now is a transdermal preparation, a gel that's built on the gel that men use to replace testosterone if they have low testosterone. So that's on the market and been used by millions of men very safely and effectively. So using that gel containing natural testosterone and a progestin that's delivered in the same gel, we can, by a simple, very small volume of gel applied to each shoulder once a day, provide the both hormones in the levels that are necessary to do everything we need them to do. It took us a long time to get there. So we began our first study in humans of the two gels, the two hormones, each in a separate gel, back in 2004. And we got the right concentration. Then we did a study to show we could inhibit sperm production and then it recovers. And we want this to be reversible because the only method available to men that's really effective is vasectomy, and that's not reversible. So we want young men to be able to use this if they're interested in it, ones who haven't necessarily had their family yet. So we had to demonstrate that it was fully reversible and that, you know, it was highly acceptable again. And I will say one of the things that's happened that's not part of the protocol is a number of couples who've completed their year of efficacy and their recovery decided they wanted to get pregnant, and they've been able to do so. And we've had a number of babies now that have been born, and everybody's very happy about all of that. So that demonstrates the return to fertility that we'd like to be able to promise. Again, it's not part of the protocol, but we haven't seen people try and not been able to succeed in getting pregnant and having a healthy baby.
Yeah. The people who would participate in a study like that presumably are people who are, you know, they're self-identifying as people who would be interested in that method. Do you have an idea of how willing people would be to take that contraceptive sort of more broadly in the population?
Well, the studies that have been done in terms of acceptability, would you use it if it existed, have indicated more than 50% in most countries. There have been many studies that had been done long ago, and now a whole new set have been done very recently. And the level of enthusiasm among men is still between 50 to 65%.
Beyond progress in contraceptives that target sperm, are there any other developments in contraception that you find promising?
Yeah, well, we're working on a new injectable that we think will be very effective and will not have the weight gain or the mood changes that are associated with Depo-Provera. And we're really looking forward to the next stage of development of that. At the moment, it's in the dose finding stage. And as soon as we have the dose that we think is the perfect dose, we will move into the large phase 3 study to show the efficacy rate of this product. And then again, we'll go to FDA for approval on that. So that we're pretty excited about that one. We have another product that is a vaginal ring that has this potent progestin, but also a natural estradiol. And I should mention that the gels for male and this estradiol progestin ring are both collaborations with the Population Council. NICHD and the Population Council work pretty closely for this common goal of new contraceptive development. And so that has the advantage of being very safe for women and even women who have a higher risk of blood clots. So we think it's a very safe product, and it also allows women to use it in a way that they can kind of control when bleeding occurs, which may be an advantage to some women who like to, you know, not bleed when they don't want to bleed.
Diana Blythe is chief of the Contraceptive Development Program at the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, which is part of the National Institutes of Health in the U.S. You've been listening to Spark. The show was made by Michelle Parisi, Samrui Johannes, Matt Muse, McKenna Hadley-Burke, and me, Nora Young. And by Jonathan Eig, Crystal Littlejohn, and Diana Blythe. Follow Spark on your favorite podcast app, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, where we are Spark CBC. I'm Nora Young. Talk to you soon.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.